the young lady.
Thank you, Candace. I was expecting a little more than that, but my name's Larry Thomas, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm glad to be with you guys, and it's been a great conference, and it's, 9 months ago, Ralph had called me up and asked me if I would do step two. And every day I've been thinking about that step. Now, I'm here to talk on 8 and 9. But you will damn well better know that before this weekend's over, you're going to hear about step two. If I got to find you in the lobby, you're going to hear about, and don't be sending Ron. I know the difference. He's a humble one. I'm coming after you. We're going to hear step. Don't send the voice. Don't send the conference. It'll become the conference ear by the time I'm. We're going to hear step two. So I'm glad to be with you. And up till this point, I always got to remember that when we're following our principles of this program, that our co-founder Bill always thought that we were coming along right with him. And the last paragraph of the first step in the 12 and 12 says, we stood ready to do anything to lift this merciless obsession. I can't think of a better word for this thing that we have. Merciless. And that we're now on this way, and up to this point, it's been about us. And we enjoy that. It's been about us looking at conceding to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics, looking over our lives, coming to believe in something, turning our life and our will over to writing about it. Now we're going to start. Now we're moving out. Now we're doing that thing that in my book, Alcoholics Anonymous, our book, Alcoholics Anonymous, is the delusion that we are like other people has to be smashed. Now, how are you going to smash a delusion? That's what this step is all about. If you want to know what God's will for you, this is a book of hints. All through it. And right in the doctor's opinion, he talks about the problem and the solution, the phenomenon of craving and the psychic change. He makes no beefs about that. And that's what I'm trying to have done to me as I'm going through this process, you see. And the delusion that I am like other people, what does that have to do with this step? Well, for me, I've had this ongoing fantasy and this fascination with normal people. Now, and I always compare myself to them. I don't compare myself to the drunks. Because I don't think I have this thing. So I'm constantly comparing myself to people who are totally out of my league. And wondering why I'm frustrated and coming up short all the time. And one of the things I've seen that normal people can do, they can let bygones be bygones. They can get by with a mere apology. But not so for the alcoholic. And this delusion that we are like other people, it permeates my sobriety all the way through. I am like so many folks in Alcoholics Anonymous. And to the untrained eye, it looks like we all get along. Except when you sit in my chair. There's going to be some moving on going on, you know. And one of the things that happened to me when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous is I would see people get sober and they would stop drinking and they would get a job and they would get a car and they'd get a place to live with and somebody to dance with. And to the untrained eye, it looks like the treatment for alcoholism is normal living. Now, nothing could be further from the truth. And we all know that, most of us here. That you don't even have to come to AA to get those things. That takes hard work and good fortune. But the treatment to this malady that we have will be and always will be for folks like me, will be the perpetuation of this gift. Me and you in this book. The perpetuation of this gift. And I had no idea that this delusion was going to be smashed. And thank God for a home group. Thank God for a home group. Now, I didn't come to believe when I got here. I didn't come to believe. What I had to do is I had to come to serve a power greater than myself. I didn't come to believe a power greater than but I came to serve a power greater than myself. And it is amazing that the more you serve him, the clearer he becomes. And that the more you serve you, the darker you become. And I had no idea what was going on with me. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, you see, when I think of sobriety today, the thought of drinking or using doesn't even enter my mind. When I think of sobriety today, I think about the way that I live. I think about how I conduct myself when I'm away from you, because everybody can be good for an hour and a half with the sponsor right there, you know what I mean? But what do you like when you leave here? What do you like at home and work and play? So you see, that's where the real member is without telling anybody he is. See, and I didn't know that. You see, but I can't live the way I used to live and expect to stay sober. I needed to change the way that I lived. I'm an undisciplined man. And Alcoholics Anonymous would slowly but surely start teaching me something that I never wanted anything to do with and had been demanding my entire life. And it was a thing called respect. I've been demanding respect my entire life. But when I started showing respect for the people in my home group and the people in my life, I began to see what a valuable principle that was going to be for me. And I come from good people. I come from great people. I love my mom and dad. I was born in Detroit. I came out to California when I was about 4 years old. I was brought up in a little foster home for a while. And my mom and dad finally got together again. And my mom's a sweet lady. She's a great little lady. She's about this high. And my mom used to eat speed. She used to eat those diet pills. So she was always running around the house around midnight, you know, and sorting out, you know, nuts and bolts in the garage all night long and, you know, raking the neighbor's yard around 4 a.m, you know. And, you know, and she would eat the speed and make Afghans. So everything in the house had fresh Afghans on it, you know. Couches had Afghans. Chairs had Afghans, you know. My dad's golf clubs had little poodle heads, you know. And whenever time you got up, she was up doing stuff, you know. And she had a little room, and you can hear her all night in there. It's like a little garment district, you know. And when you eat that kind of speed, you have a lot of hobbies. And you like to do them all at once. You know what I mean? You're moving, man, you know. And one of her favorite hobbies was to eat those diet pills and make these big jigsaw puzzles, right? Not the 3,000 pieces. The 30,000 pieces, you know, of the Mojave Desert. And this would excite her. This would excite her. You know, she'd run around. It's going to be a beige night tonight, honey, you know, and go off and go to the drugstore and get her prescription filled and, you know, come back home and plop open that card table and put her one and only muumuu on and eat some more speed and start smoking these Raleigh cigarettes. She smoked Raleigh cigarettes because they had coupons on the back. And she would save these coupons to buy more yarn. It was a hideous cycle she was caught up in. And I loved being around my mom. I loved being around my mom. Now, what was to happen to me when I would come with you for, which I hope was the last time, on May 2nd, 1982, is me and you would start on this fact-finding process. We're dealing with the facts. We're not talking about drunken behavior. And we're talking about the facts. We're talking about the things that we were going to die with, you see. The things that keep it up late at night, you know. And I would look back and I would start this fact-finding process and I would see things that I was doing as a child and dragging them into my adult year. They were hooked on me like an anchor around my ankle. And one of the things that I used to do as a young kid and brought it into my adulthood is what I would do with people who would give me love and attention and affection. And it started with my mom. And you know what I would do? I would play her like a fiddle. That there would never be a time too inconvenient or an age too old for me not to put the tap on that lady. And I never want to forget that. I never want to forget what it was like to be 17, 18 years old and be put away somewhere for a small period of time. And you come out and you're supposed to come back at home and you don't. No, you show up. You're supposed to come home on a Monday, but you show up on a Thursday. But you don't even show up at home. No, you show up at your mom's place of business. See, she's working in a dry cleaners and cleaning people's houses, and I'm ashamed of her. But I'm not too ashamed to show up at 9 o'clock in the morning and stand in a parking lot with my drunken mud on, and I'm about from here to those back doors looking at her in that dry cleaners, waiting for the customers to get out of there so I can make my move. And with that Thunderbird wine and that blood all over me, I'm staring at my mom. With that rain hitting me, I start walking my way to the lady's place of business. And one more time, I come in through the door and startle her with my presence, which would be an ongoing thing in that lady's life. And she breaks out her little wallet, and the picture falls out when I'm 8 years old on a Little League team. The only decent picture she'd have of me until I meet you. And she peels off that $1 and $2, and I run off to Long Beach, Wilmington, where I'm going to die. Now, the thing that brings it home to me this afternoon over here in Los Angeles is you take this same man, and you bring me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with my so-called desperation and willing to go to any length, and you stick me in a home group. And you put the secretary of that home group about the same distance as me and my mom in that parking lot. And I need to ask you something if you're new. How come when my life depends on it, I can't walk that same distance and ask the secretary of a meeting for a job at a meeting that's going to save my life? But I can walk that distance and use my mom and folks like her time and time and time and time again. And I'm here to share with you if you're new. That if my alcoholism doesn't kill me, my selfishness and my self-centeredness, make no mistake about that. Which is why it's necessary for a guy with 32 years to still have a job in every home group meeting that he goes to. And it's not so that I can run off to L.A. and tell you about it. For one reason and one reason only, and we've been hearing it all weekend. I will never get so sober that I can't get drunk again. But I can get so drunk that I can never make it back. And I never want to forget what it used to be like. What we used to be like and what happened and what we're like today. I never want to forget that, what it was like to be in and out of what I thought was Alcoholics Anonymous year after year after year and looking through your windows and wondering if I'll ever be in the middle of this thing called life. I never want to forget that. And if I can go through this book with you and my sponsor, and find that thing that keeps me from serving you, I will have found the key to life. Because the moment that I started serving the thing that I wanted so much from, I couldn't keep it from bleeding in every area of my life. You can't stop it. There's a miracle here. And it's one you can't pray about. One you can't bring, but it's something you must do about it. And I had no idea. Now, my dad was a happy drunk. My dad was a happy singing the blues, Nat King Cole, Bobby Darin drunk. My old man loved to drink and sneak into his own home. It was an amazing thing, man. You know, he was a window-climbing alkie, which I think is a lost art in Alcoholics Anonymous. You don't hear about those guys anymore, man. Standing on that gas meter, pounding on that window for 2 hours, hoping it's his own home. You know what I mean? Getting ready to make the big dive in there, you know. And my dad was a World War II vet. He proud of it, proud of the Navy, man. My dad was a World War II vet, hard working man. Worked at a refinery, started off as a janitor, and after 30 some years become plant manager of this thing. He's the kind of guy that starts things and finishes them. My dad has that thing that when things get tough, he reaches down somewhere inside and finds this little Michigan God and works through things. He has that type of character. His son don't. His son is wrapped with a 4-inch belt of lazy ass that, you know, the only thing I think about when I wake up is my nap, really, you know. I mean, everything's around 2:30 in my house, you know what I mean? And my dad used to take my inventory every day. You don't know how good you got it. Back when I was your age, I was really tough. We really had it tough. And he did, man. He did. He worked in that depression. And, you know, he knew, you know, his father died at a young age, choked on his tongue in a convulsion. His mother was a Detroit prostitute, and she hung herself in a jail, and he brought up his kid brother, and he had a dream, and that dream was to marry my mom and come out to California and live the good life, because that's what everybody was doing. And he only wanted to go good for me. All he wanted for me was the best, that I would live a life that was totally opposite of his, where I wouldn't have to want. And so they worked two jobs. And I grew up hating him. I grew up hating the old man. I don't know what happened to me. But you see, I'm always seeking approval. And I found out on this inventory that I was always seeking my dad's approval. And it wasn't because that I loved him. It's because I was afraid of him. See, I was hearing what was going on in that house late at night and early in the morning. And I could hear things, and I seen things, and things were being done to me. And I felt so guilty about that. And I didn't trust my mom because she was letting it happen to her and everybody else. And I didn't trust my dad because he was doing it. And I had so many questions, but I didn't trust these folks. And I grew up hating this guy. And my whole goal in life was to grow up and finally get eye to eye with that guy so that me and him can go at it. And if that's what doing good and all that stuff is, and I just didn't trust what was going on there. And I didn't know what to do with all this. And along around 5 or 6 years old, they got pregnant. My dad come into my room and told me that I was going to have a baby brother. And I start oiling up my glove. I start thinking about me and that kid brother, how we're going to go to the drag races and the beach and stuff like that. 9 months later, my dad comes into my room and tells me that my baby brother died. I don't remember having any ounce of compassion or anything. I went after the old man with all 60 pounds yelling and screaming, "You promised me. You promised me," and my dad was going to be at the top of my list. And you know what else that did to a kid? What type of God would create a baby and kill it? Now, I don't trust my mom and dad, and I don't trust this Michigan God my mom's been bragging about. And I don't know where to go with that stuff. But at 11 years old, there was four of us in a garage, and we started passing around a bottle of Four Rose whiskey. I didn't have to worry about being good anymore. I stepped into the sweetest window I'd ever found. I didn't have to be afraid anymore. I didn't have to worry about what I was going to be when I grow up. I found everything that I needed. Now, I didn't head off to Skid Row and lose my paper out the next day and come to AA, you know what I mean? But I marked that spot. I marked that spot. And the older that I got, the more I leaned on it. And by the time I got into high school, kids were going to their locker room to get some books, and I'm going to my locker to get some half pint of Four Rose whiskey or some Thunderbird or some barbiturates to take away the shakes. I started dating this little Mexican girl, and she had some brothers. They like cars, and I love cars to this day. I love cars. They're custom cars, when I was a young kid, I used to help this guy with a dragster, and I used to chase oil for him and be on his little pit crew and stuff like that, you know? And I started hanging around these little Mexicans, and I got this little girlfriend named Lupi, and we'd drive around, and we'd drink our Thunderbird wine, and we'd listen to the Four Tops and the OJs and Marvin Gaye, and God, I loved it. Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes, man, I loved it, you know. And I was in my plumbing truck 2 weeks ago, and the Four Tops came on, and I just started sinking in my little car, man, you know. We lowered our cars right down to the ground, man. Had our 62 Chevy Impalas dropped right down to the ground. I had my hair all big like a Bakersfield tumbleweed. I had my white T-shirt and my black khaki pants up to here, you know, and driving around with a frown on because my ass hurts from bouncing around all day, you know. Loopy's girlfriends were telling me that men who are well endowed had big feet. I had a pair of 15-inch shoes I was driving around with, man. Somebody tripped over my foot this morning, and I felt proud, you know. Let me move that thing, you know. I loved it, man. I loved it. One day we were drinking that 151 rum all day long, man. just hitting that stuff all day long. 5 o'clock in the afternoon, Loopy says, let's go to the Jack in the Box and talk to the puppet, you know. We were a lonely couple, you know, and we pull into the Jack in the Box and I see about 10 puppets, man, and she goes, roll up and talk to the puppet, you know, and I run them over. The puppet's hanging down, you know, and the cops come and they arrest me. They throw me on the hood of the car. They shatter my hair all over the place, you know, and I don't drive till I'm 30. Well, big deal. Let Rudy drive. There's nothing like riding shotgun, man. Looking at yourself in that mirror, got your hair all big and flat because you've been sleeping on the window all night. You got 30 pounds of tamale puke on your chest and you feel like dancing, you know. I loved it. I ran into a guy like that several years ago. I was up at the Glendale Mall. This kid comes walking by me. He was a macho kid. He had his mom's earrings on. and he had his ears pierced. No, he had them drilled out. He had these big holes drilled out, which is every sponsor's dream, because if that guy gives you any lip, you say, hey, come back here. You got him. You know what I mean? And he had ball bearings. He had ball bearings in his eyes and in his ears and in his nose and in his throat and on his tongue. And he had a chain around his neck hooked to his wallet and stuff. And I walked by him and he goes, well, what are you looking at? I says, I don't have a damn clue what I'm looking at. You know, I wanted to squirt him with some WD-40 to make sure he keeps moving on, you know. Now I sponsor the guy. I live down in Chula Vista. His name's Ron. He used to call me. What do you want me to do? And I says, well, Ronnie, why don't you unlock yourself, for God's sakes, you know. Well, I go to your meetings and I feel so different. Really? Maybe you're the only one wrapped up in a chain link fence, Ronnie. How about that? But I started on this path, and every time I drank, it did what it was supposed to do. Every time I drank. It took that little scared little person and made him somebody. And I had no idea it was going to turn on me. I had no idea that in 1975 I'd be coming back from an institution in Phoenix for writing prescriptions. I came back to 1974 over here at the LA City Hall, and I get a probation officer. He puts me on Anabuse. And I hadn't stopped drinking since the time I was 13. And he puts me on this Anabuse and sticks me in a little house, a little hotel over in downtown Torrance. I'm at this little downtown Torrance hotel. I'm 2 months without anything. And after 2 months, my probation officer gives me a slip of paper to go to Refinery to be a part-time janitor. And I'm taking a bus because I'm not going to drive till I'm 30. And when you take a bus, you're either 2 hours early or 2 hours late. You know, there's none of this, I'll be right there, you know what I mean? And I go to this Refinery, and I'm early, and I'm waiting for my interview, and I go to this Little League dugout across the street. And I go absolutely out of my mind, stone cold sober. Become hysterical, maniacal, become somewhat catatonic, and somebody calls the paramedics. They come and get me, and they send me to the Harbor General Hospital. Harbor General Hospital, I'm sitting in the emergency ward with an arm and a leg strapped down, and they're looking through my paperwork. And they seem to think that because of some of the things that have happened in my life, that maybe I need to go to a state hospital out by Oxnard and be observed for about 30 or 60 days. So they sent me out there, and a year later I came out totally observed, you know. We can't find a thing in that man, you know. And they gave me certain medications to take away these certain things. See, there was a man that drowned. I was over there in Phoenix. And this guy drowned. My buddy drowned. He was twice my age, and he drowned. And I went to, we were at Saguaro Lake, and I went to dive after him, and it was just muddy brown, and I couldn't see him. But I can hear him. I can hear the screaming underwater. And I gave it two or three shots, and then the thought in my head says, when he's gone, you get his dope. And I let him drown. And I would never be able to get those screams out of my mind. To this day, my little wife, Rosie, looks at me like, you know, what happened, you know? I'll have one of those little epilepsy. And I couldn't get it out of my mind. And I didn't know what to do with that. And I come out of that institution in 1975, and they gave me some medication to take, and it took away a certain things. But I tell you what you can't medicate away in an alcoholic, and that is this idea that maybe this time it's going to be different. You see, that's the only thing not drinking ever brings into me. See, because I've been trying to live this delusional lie that a lot of us have been trying to live, that have been imposed on us by a lot of people, that if you stop drinking, everything will be all right. You see, and I stop drinking and everything's not all right. And the longer I stay sober, the worse I get. And if you're not doing AA and you're not drinking, you are in a most wicked place. And I'd had no idea what was going on with me. But I ran out of Thorazine, and after a couple months, and they found me in 1975 at a gas station over on Alvaro Street, curled up like a dead dog, 120 pounds in yellow. They sent me up to Wayside, where I'm supposed to do 2.5 years, and I'm up at Wayside, and after a couple weeks, they put a bunch of us in a bus, and in 1975, they sent me down to a courthouse in South Bay, Torrance. I'm in a holding tank about half this size. And in 1975, at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, everybody in that tank is gone. All the buses are gone. All these other guys are gone that I came in on the chain with. It's just me and a Vons bag and no hope, wondering where they're going to send me now. And in 1975, a Scottish man with a patch opened this door and he says, "Are you Larry Thomas?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I am." He said, "Come with me, son. You're going to AA." And I thought, AA, I've never heard of that. I've heard of OR and PO, but what's AA, you know? Who's this Scottish pirate all of a sudden, you know? And in 1975, that man took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was ready for a long ride up north and maybe some lunch, you know? He took me for a 15-minute car ride to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in that car, he told me the news. He said, "Son, I know you've had a tough life and you feel different." He says, "But I can't wait for you to meet these people." These people. He says, "In Alcoholics Anonymous, son, the more different you feel, the more qualified you are." And the man took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1975. And I took one look around that room and I seen how different that I was. You see, because I did what I've been doing my entire life. I sat in rooms waiting for you to do something for me. And what I was waiting to be done to me, God was waiting to do through me. It wasn't until of May 2nd, 1982, when I called up a bald-headed carpenter. I was down at the Beacon Light Mission over there in Wilmington. And I've been running around this thing for years. And I called up a man, and I did what I always did that way. I called up a man in Alcoholics Anonymous named Don Adamson. I said, "Don, I don't know what to do with my life. Would you come and get me? I'm down here at the Beacon Light Mission." And he told me the most profound thing I've ever heard in my life. He said, "No." He says, "You know where we are. You know what we got. Why don't you get your rusty rear down here yourself? I'm tired of chasing after you." And he hung up. And I took the longest walk of my life. But I went around that corner, and I started crying because I knew that my alcoholism was like a tail on a kite, that it was just up, the wind's going to hit me and I'm off and running. I didn't want to do that anymore. Everything in me didn't want to do it, and I didn't know how not to do it because I'd been down with the pigs before. And being down with the pigs has never been enough to stop me. I'm powerless over that thing, and I got so afraid, but I came to believe in that afternoon. And I didn't come to believe in God, and I didn't come to believe in the book, and I didn't come to believe in the AA or a sponsor. I came to believe in the hopelessness and the futility of my life at that moment. And I knew I'd always be like that. I knew it'd always be like this. Nothing would ever change. It's always going to be like this, Larry. And I took the longest walk of my life, that 10 miles with my poopy pants and no hope, and I waddle up to this little dingy club that they'd ran me out of. And I waddled up to a guy and I asked a man something I never asked a man in AA. I said, "Don, I don't know what to do with my life. Would you be my sponsor?" And that man lit up like a chandelier for 5 seconds. Then he lit into me for 20 minutes. And he was to take me through these steps. And we started on this inventory. And we took blame out of there. Right? The word blame was no longer in there. And we started on this inventory of mother and father. And I seen how I rubbed my mom and dad's nose. I introduced my mom and dad to a level of living they didn't know existed. And then demanded. See? I never want to forget what I didn't know what to do with that. I'd beat up my mom before. I snuck in on her one night. I snuck into her house and she's watching Johnny Carson and I'm on her lap and she's rocking me with my drunken mud on and I can feel every tear hitting me as she's praying to this Michigan God, please help my baby boy. And I said, Mom, it's going to be all right. It's going to be all right, Mom. And she waddled off to bed and I start looking underneath the cupboards for that bottle of wine that I know my dad has there. And I couldn't find it and I start tearing up her kitchen like the days of wine and roses. And she came out of her little bed and she waddled up to me. She said, honey, what's wrong? And I said, don't you, honey, what's wrong with me? And I started banging my mom around until I got blood out of her nose. You see, that fourth column for a guy like me, even though I have the resentment and we write down these things, as a result of that resentment that you had, how did you get even? How did you make them pay the price for the hate that you had and the distrust? Because they're going to pay. They're going to pay. And I never want to forget that. And my first spawn, and my father. And I remember making that amends to my mother. You see, Don was a smart man. He knew my record. You see, I'm one of those kind of guys in AA that every time I stop drinking for a week or two, I run around shouting the good news. And the first ones that I go to are the first ones that are going to get used. You see, we are not talking about an apology. And every time I would do that, every time I would stop drinking in AA, I'd run off to Mom's. Everything's going to be all right. I'm not drinking. And heck, after a couple of years, every time I would mention AA, she'd go, oh, God, he's going to be drinking again. You know, she'd prepare herself. And my sponsor, a wise man, he says, no, no, no. You leave your mom and dad alone right now. You wait till you get yourself settled down. You don't be bothered. You do this. This is your record. This is what you do. You call your mom and dad and you ask them how they're doing, but don't you start apologizing and making amends right now. They've heard this. Let them see you for a while. And eventually I got to sit with that little lady. And she wouldn't hug me. It was one of these. And because of Alcoholics Anonymous, my mom was introduced to her son and she was introduced to me. And right now she's over in Torrance. She's 84 years old. You see? She looks forward to seeing me. She's having some memory issues right now. And she's having some breathing issues right now. And she's got me power of attorney. And I'm taking care of that little lady. And I sit in front of her and she gets pretty forgetful. And she has people taking her blood and stuff, you know, and she forgets their names. And they're the same people, you know. Several times a week. I was over there the other day and this guy's supposed to be taking her Coumadin check. Same guy for 2 weeks. We're all over there together and she looks at me and she says, who is that fucker? You know what I mean? It's just out of nowhere, man, you know. I said, that's Raul, that's your blood guy, you know. And my mom has this balcony. And on this balcony, she lives in this place where there's other balconies, and all the other little ladies have real flowers on their balconies, except my mom. She's got plastic flowers. I noticed that a couple years ago, and that bothered me. I thought, you chump, Larry, Mr. AA, here's your mom's the only lady with plastic flowers. Everybody else has real ones. Why don't you get her some real flowers? And I asked my mom. I said, Mom, I says, I want to get you some real flowers to put on your balcony. Get you some roses and stuff. She said, I don't want them, honey. I said, no, you don't have to pay for them. I'm going to take care of them. I'm going to put them up there and get you some roses and some lilies and some birds of paradise. And she said, I don't want them, honey. I don't want any real flowers. I said, you don't have to worry about taking care of it. I wouldn't let it go, you know. She says, honey, I don't want any real flowers. She says, I love my plastic flowers. She says, I love to sit in my rocker and watch the hummingbirds suffer. I don't go there to see my mom to make amends. I go there because I love her and I'm her son. I'm not that mechanical. You see, if we are painstaking through a certain phase of development, if we are painstaking, that means you're going to give something an honest effort. I've never given anything an honest effort. I'm a something for nothing guy. And what these amends started showing me before I was halfway through was that for the first time in my life, I was given something 100%. And I came to believe in Alcoholics Anonymous. I came to believe that maybe I'm not running a lie on myself. That maybe this is the real deal. For the first time in my life, I'm living in reality. And I bought the deal. I started seeing myself doing something that I'd never seen before. I became responsible. That was the thing that was all through my inventory, was being irresponsible. Taking advantage of people, stealing things and all that stuff. And now Alcoholics Anonymous. You see all these steps, you see what they're getting ready to do now? That sixth step isn't about getting pretty and good. They're getting you ready. Bill's getting me ready. Because can you imagine what it would be like if we showed up making amends like we were when we were 5 days sober? Have that guy on your doorstep again, you know what I mean? He's preparing us. He's getting us ready. He's getting these defects of character so that we can be useful. He's getting that stuff out of the way so that we start going to make amends. They open the door and they know something's changed. Yeah, it's that jackass, but there's something different about him. And maybe, just maybe, they'll hear you out. Maybe, just maybe. And he's getting us ready through that six. He's preparing us to do something. We got a job to do here. We're marked men. I'm a marked man. And Bill was getting me ready to finally make amends to folks that are putting their harms out of the way. I'm going to clear up this wreckage. Not so that I can run around with a peaceful head, that maybe they will. Maybe they can start tending to their lives and they don't got to be preoccupied when they hear a siren or read the obituaries or something like that. And I didn't want to go to my dad. I didn't want nothing to do with my dad. But my sponsor insisted. Johnny told me, why don't you treat him like you treat me? In fact, treat him a little bit better. And I said, Johnny, I don't know what to talk to him about when I see him. He says, why don't you start talking about things that interest him? He says, make it an effort to get to know your father. My father had some type of a kidney operation, and I'm 5 or 6 years sober, and I run down to the hospital to see him, and he grabbed my little hand, and he said, don't wait till I'm in the hospital to come see me. And I started seeing my dad every week on Thursdays. That was our chili day. I'd go pick him up at his little place, and we'd go to Norm's and have chili. And sometimes there wasn't any conversation at all. But I started. I started talking about things that would interest him. I didn't bore him with this AA stuff. And I went to Lawndale and talked, or none of that crap. Started talking about his life. I started sharing with him about my wife. I started sharing with him about working in a refinery like he did. I started sharing to him that some of the stuff that maybe he would be interested in about his son. And I brought him into my life. And every Thursday was our chili. And Dad got that liver cancer. And he started dwindling away. And I was taking care of Dad. And we'd go over to his house. And I'd watch over. And I'd sleep with him. And my dad's only request was that, don't let me die in a hospital. Let me die in my own home. And if in the hospice people, if your daddy can stand on his own 2 feet, he can stay where he's at. And so my job, he says, is when those hospice people come up, he says, you push me up so I can stand on my feet. And we pushed him up, and he sat down with his little Dodger hat. And the lady noticed that he had a pack of cigarettes, a pack of Luckies over there. She said, Mr. Thomas, she says, you shouldn't be smoking. He says, what's it going to do, kill me? And I And I spent those days with Dad and our Thursday, and I'm in there writing his check, and it got quiet, and I turned around one morning, and Daddy had passed. And I went over there, and I put his eyes shut, and I kissed him. And I got to walk the man out that walked me in. But one of the things when I was making amends to Dad that he told me, when I was making amends to my father, and I told him about that baby brother thing. I told him about how I blamed him. He said, "Son, I've done a lot of things in my life. I've been to war, World War II, and my ship sunk. I've seen a lot of tragedies. I've seen a lot of things. I've done a lot of things. And I need to tell you something, Larry, that bar none, the hardest thing I've ever had to do was to watch you for 9 months collecting baseball cards. And have to go into your little room and tell you that your baby brother died. I didn't want to do that, son. And I'm so sorry that happened. And I wished it didn't. I didn't know that he would remember that. Or even give it a thought a day. But I walked that man that walked me into life. And when I kissed him, I didn't feel weird about it. Now, why was that? That's because several times a week I'm in a home group, and at the end of every meeting I hold hands with men and say our prayer. That's because several times a year I get to give a man a cake and kiss him and thank him. That's because one time a year my sponsor will give me a cake and kiss me and thank me. And so affection to men became okay to do without feeling weird. And if there was ever a man that deserved it, despite what he did wrong, I was a bad son, Bobby. I was a bad son. And to let him know that I truly regretted that was priceless. To let the guy know that I don't hate him no more. And that realistically, if I could be half the guy he was, boy, I'd be top of the game, man. You see, because I'm a loser. I'm a hostile loser. Losers don't get hope by digging in and working through stuff. Losers get hope by starting over. And that's the story of my life. My inventory was a series of fresh starts. Because that's the only way we get hope when you're losing. And one of the amends that I had to make when I was sober was to my little girl, my daughter Lauren. You see, first time in my life I got married in AA. I was about 5 years sober. Lasted a whole year and a half, which is long for us. You know what I mean? And the hardest thing for me to do was to leave a little girl. But you see, I couldn't live with her mother no more under the way we were living. I didn't want to leave that little girl. But the Women in Alcoholics Anonymous told me, you may not be somebody's husband, but you'll always be somebody's father. Don't you ever let that little girl wonder where you're at. And I would write that little girl on that yellow paper, and the women in AA would say, no, 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 write her on Pocahontas paper, you know. And I'd write that little girl letters every week or two. I would call her up on the phone. I would drive from LA to Phoenix to visit my little girl, because if I can fly to Ohio and talk to the masses, I could certainly drive to Phoenix and see my little girl. What's more spiritual? And every time I would take that drive, my head would start hammering on me. What kind of dad are you? What kind of dad would go see his daughter only a couple times a year? What kind of dad are you? She needs a better dad. What are you doing with this stuff for? She's going to forget you, for God's sakes. You're not there that, you know. And by the time I'd drive over there and see my daughter, we'd have those daughter-daddy dates. And we'd go out to eat. And I would take her to those places where she could make her own ashtrays and write names on it and coffee cups. And we would go to the movies and stuff like that. And this would go on several times a year after. One time I went over there and we're sitting across from each other at dinner, and she looked at me. She was 8 or 9 years old, or in the 8th or 9th grade. And she says, Daddy, she says, the kids are making fun of me at school because I'm so smart. She said, did that ever happen to you? And like any good alky, I said, hell yes. You know. Well, my daughter's 27 years old now. And a couple years ago, I'm driving over there and sit across from this little lady. She says, "Daddy, I'm in love. I got a man in my life, and I really love him." I said, "Really?" She says, "But there's a glitch." And that makes you feel great, you know. I says, "What's the glitch, honey?" She says, "Well, she has two daughters. He has two daughters, and they're 6 and 7. And he came over to the house last night, and he was crying." I said, "Well, what was he crying about?" "Well, he's afraid that because of the divorce that these little girls are going to forget him." And I said, "Well, what did you tell him?" She says, "Well, it was quite easy. I told him to write those little girls every week, to call them up, take them to places where they can make their own coffee cups and write their names on the ashtrays and stuff, and go on daughter and daddy dates." And she says, "John, if you do that, those little girls will never forget you." She says, "I know that for a fact. Daddy, the reason that I love you so much, you never gave up on me. You never stopped seeing me. You were consistent. Even when Mom would call you when you were halfway over and tell you, 'No, you can't come,' you kept coming anyway. I'll always remember that, and I love you for that, for never forgetting me." I love that little girl. Her boyfriend's going to be a rapper. Can't wait, you know. I told him, man, I said, "Put your hands in the air like you just don't care. And get yourself a real career," you know what I mean? But all the men's aren't happy, joyous, and free, are they? I tell you, my grand sponsor, Clancy, really helped me out on this. Because I told you that I'm going through this every time I'm visiting her. And me and Clancy are talking in New Mexico, and we're riding to the airport. I said, "Clancy, this is killing me. I got to talk to my little girl about making this amends." And she was only 10 then. He says, "Well, what's going on?" And I told him the whole litany about, you know, all that. And he says, "My God, how old is she now?" And she was about 10 or 11. He says, "Well, what's her demeanor like?" And I says, "Well, she seems to be, you know, pretty happy. And is she doing good in school? And does she have friends?" I said, "Oh, yeah, she's doing great." He says, "Does she get along with her mom and any problems?" I said, "Oh, no, there's no problem. They get along good." He says, "What's her general personality like?" And I says, she's just always happy and feeling good. He said, "Why do you want to go over there and ruin that?" At the expense of others, right? He says, "Why don't you wait till she grows up, and when she's curious, she'll give you a call and ask you." And by golly, she did. Can you imagine that? If I would have took things. The sponsorship is so important on these amends. Before I wrote any letter, and before I took any drive, and before I visited, I ran that by a sponsor. Left to my own devices, I could have ruined so many things and done so much harm. One of the biggest resentments that I had, and one of the hardest amends to make, was my sister Linda. You talk about immature. My big sister had this, my nephew. He was my nephew. And if there's anything cool, it's being an uncle. I had a cool uncle. My uncle used to take me to coffee houses and take me to the drag races. And I had a cool uncle, you know. And I wanted to be a cool uncle. And my sister had this little nephew, Ryan. And I hated him. I started resenting Ryan. You want to know why? Because there's nothing more magical than a grandpa and a grandson. And I'm seeing this happening. And I'm hating this little kid. And I'm envious and I'm jealous of a little kid. And he's growing up. And I'm giving him the tough guy, the cold shoulder, and he loves hanging around me. He loves laughing with me, and I wouldn't go to any of his soccer games or anything like that, you know. Just so jealous of this. And the older he got, the better looking he got, and I ain't having that. And just a sharp kid. And yet I here I am with my resentment and trying to be a tough uncle and all that. Well, the kid was about 19 or 20 years old, going to graduate from Humboldt University. 2 weeks before graduation, we get a call that Ryan dropped dead on a basketball court. I don't got to worry about Ryan anymore. I don't have to worry about being number one. Got rid of that one. And it ate me up. Kept me far from being with my sister. Felt so guilty about that. That I wasted all that time about that when I could have been a good uncle. Could have been that cool uncle. I didn't know how to get rid of that. Well, my beautiful wife, Rosie, started sponsoring this little lady in Canada. And this lady has a little son. He's 10 years old. And she's making amends. And for the first time in this little kid's life, he's going to see his grandma and grandpa. And they're getting ready to go to Canada and see grandma and grandpa for the first time. She says, "Davis, are you excited about seeing grandma and grandpa?" He says, "I can't wait." He says, "But before we go, we got to go to JCPenney's. I got to get me a coat and tie." She says, "Oh my God, honey, it's just grandma and grandpa." He says, "You don't understand." He says, "I listened to one of your CDs, and Larry T says that when you show respect for the thing you love, you wear a coat and tie. And I want grandma and grandpa to see my coat and tie because I love them." And they got to the airport, and this kid's coming down the escalator, and this little jackass has got his coat and tie on, man. Grandma and grandpa are down there. They're looking at him, man, and they lit right up. And the kid wrote me. And he says that I'm his hero. And I thought, Ryan. I've got myself a little Ryan that I'm going to start writing to. And when I went over to Scotland to see those pirates over there, I got him a tie in his namesake. I got him the color, man. And I sent him that tie. He wears that thing to bed, for God's sakes, man, you know. And it isn't about my tape or none of that. It's that I finally got to add something into somebody's life called respect instead of take something out of it or put something dirty into it. I got to put something good into this thing. And that kid's mother was going to take a cake not too long after that. And she went down to her club to take her cake, and Orion had this little tie on. And these guys poked fun at him and asked him, "How come you got a tie on? You going to a funeral?" And he says, "No, I'm showing respect for my mom. She's taking a cake tonight, and I'm showing respect for the thing that saved her life." How about that? Got to put a little bit of something back into this thing. He's getting you ready. He's getting you ready. Now, that's the last amends that I had to make. Actually, we don't have time. But I want to tell you something. I started sponsoring a guy that's blind. And it's good to see we have a handicap section over here too, you know. You don't see that at most conferences, you know what I mean? But I started... Several months ago, about 5 months ago, this man came up to our meeting. And he couldn't see. And he asked me to sponsor him. And I started sponsoring this man that couldn't see. 58-year-old man, air conditioning guy. And every day I'd pick him up for the meeting and take him back. And he began to go to our meeting and, you know, what do you do with a blind guy? I put him in the greeting line. And he got to hear all your voices. And he got to remember your voices. And he'd go to our book study and listen to your reading. That's why it's so important you guys read slowly and clearly. See, some people depend on every word. And he would hear this. And once a month I have a sponsorship meeting where the guys that I sponsor, we meet and we go through a step. And we were reading the step the other day, and old Dan had time to read, and he had been to the doctor a week before, and we were all sitting there, and I'm sitting here, Darwin's sitting here, and Dan's sitting there, and it's Dan usually passes because he can't see. Well, 2 weeks ago, it was Dan's turn, and we were reading a chapter, and it was Dan's turn to read, and there was silence because we were waiting for him to say, "I pass." And he started fumbling around, and he took out this little thing he got from Braille. And it sounded like this. "Rarely have we seen." And he read the whole thing like that. And we had a moment. Now, why in the hell do you think that man was so diligent about reading that book? You think because he was afraid of drinking? Or do you think he wanted something so bad he was willing to go to any length to do? That he would do anything to relieve this merciless obsession? And these guys who can't go a week without babbling about something got to see this thing in action. Some people's lives depend on this thing. You see, there's another debt that we don't talk about in our amends. And it's all through your family line. Dr. Bob says that there's a debt that we owe AA. That there's four reasons why we go to meeting. Because of a debt. What about the debt we owe AA? This whole thing about amends is about debt. How are you paying it back? How am I paying it back? Am I one of these guys who think that I've got all mine and my payment is even? Or do I have an unending debt here? See, one of the things that I'm seeing going around is there's a change of hands in Alcoholics Anonymous. The torch is being passed. And yet I see people playing hot potato with it. I don't ever want to see that happen. I don't ever want to be that guy who doesn't want to be responsible anymore and to perpetuate this gift. You see, in the early part of May, it was mentioned earlier at this conference that Dr. Bob and Bill got together and they went to the Cyberling guest house, as we heard. And Dr. Bob says, "No, I don't want to talk to the guy." And we all know that they talked for 4 or 5. And Bob came out of that and he had a moment. He had a moment. And that's why I gather up at my home group. And that's why I'm here today. Maybe, just maybe, somebody will have a moment. Maybe, just maybe, Dan had a moment. Maybe, just maybe, there's work for us to do here to perpetuate. What a lovely gift we have. Just a matter of being painstaking through this certain phase. You see, I didn't get an immediate spiritual experience like Bill. I didn't have stuff going through the window and things lighting up. But as a result of these steps, maybe he was hoping I would have a gradual one. Maybe the thing that he was inspired to do right after that experience he had, 2 paragraphs down, what does Bill want to do? He wants to work with drunks. Immediately in the bed. Maybe, just maybe, he's hoping maybe I'd be inspired to do that as a result of these steps. And hot dog I am, man. You see, I came here and I was a crazy, intense, terrified man. And what you did is you lit a little flame in me called enthusiasm for life. I'm enthusiastic about my life and I can't wait to tell people, not from here, but from right there where we live in our home group. Don't be afraid of that torch. Be prepared. If you are new, I hope you find this book and you fall in love with it. I hope you just fall in love with this book. I hope you find a man who knows about that book and follow him. And I hope you find a group of people that in their home group, they reflect this book and serve them. Serve them well. Serve them well. If you want to be blessed, get busy being a service. And if you want joy, start sacrificing. But if you want to be happy in your life, make sure you give your life away. Share your experience, strength, and hope What a magical thing we have here. And because of these amends, we get to have people come into our lives. None of your time is wasted here. None of your time is wasted here at all. And for all the people that we're talking about, there he stood on the bank, fully clothed and in his right mind. There he was standing there, legions. You put me exactly like I was supposed to be a service. And all it took was just following you people. I love you a lot. Thank you.